Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Sometimes economic news comes in acronyms. Like today, for instance, GM and ECB and CBO. From APM, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 5th of June. Great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. My guess is that the report General Motors released today of an internal investigation into its massive recall and how the company failed to fix that badly defective ignition switch is more like the end of the beginning of GM's troubles than the actual end of them. CEO Mary Barra said today 15 people have been fired for what the report called a pattern of incompetence and neglect. Micheline Maynard covered Detroit for the New York Times for many years. She is also a contributor to Forbes. Mickey, it's good to have you back on.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
You wrote back a number of weeks ago about what Mary Barra, the CEO of GM, had to do to deal with this crisis. Number one on your list was transparency. Does her response to this report meet that standard, do you think?
There's a lot of information in the report, and it doesn't seem to answer the basic question, which is how people several layers below the CEO could either make decisions or do nothing without that information getting up the food chain. And that is the question that I want answered, and I bet you members of Congress will want that answered as well.
Yeah, and Ms. Barra will be spending some time with them, I'm sure. But it goes to point number two that you wanted Mary Barra to address, the GM culture, which is infamously siloed and opaque and not responsive to crisis. And it seems to me that this is yet more evidence of that culture still existing. What do you say?
Exactly. So this sort of takes the veil off the culture. And, you know, Mary Barra has made this point that General Motors used to be a cost-focused culture, and now it's becoming more customer-focused. But if you read the report, things were going on in 2012 and 2013. It's not like all this was 10 years ago. This is very recent stuff. So I think there's going to be a lot of work to do.
On the issue of the GM culture, you point out a couple of things that came out of this report that I wanted you to talk about for a second. The GM salute and the GM nod.
So I'll take the GM nod first. And Mary Barra even talked about this herself. This is a situation where everybody goes to the meeting, everybody hears, we've got to do better, everybody nods, and then they leave the room and nothing happens. The GM salute, and I've seen people do the GM salute. It's basically you're sitting in your chair, you have your arms folded, your elbows are kind of pointing out at folks, and it's to say, it's your problem, not my problem.
This is one of those unknowables, and I don't know, maybe Congress will get to it, an outside investigation. Mary Barra's been at that company for 30-something years. Do you suppose, as this report states, that it's possible she had no inkling?
It is possible because she did say it's a siloed company, and General Motors has 200,000 employees and many, many departments. And I think if you're in engineering, you know it's going on in engineering, but you don't necessarily know what's going on in manufacturing and marketing. But we were told over the last 20 or so years that the car companies had ripped down all these silos and everybody had these flat organizations and everyone talked to each other. And this just looks like more evidence that that didn't really happen.
All right, but wait. If a bankruptcy and what they went through in the financial crisis and the first female CEO of a car company and Rick Wagner, the CEO from a couple of years ago, getting in essence dismissed, if all of that is not enough to change the General Motors culture and now this, what will?
Maybe nothing can change it. It might be that General Motors is the way it is, and you have to manage around that. And in a good financial situation, you do just fine. And when things go bad, you see what happens. You end up in bankruptcy and need a bailout.
Boy, that's a little scary.
I hope there's never another situation as bad for General Motors as there was in 2009. And I think Mary Barra was making the same point today about the recall situation. She never wants to go through this again.
Micheline Maynard covered Detroit for the New York Times for many years. She is the newly appointed director of the Reynolds Center for Business Journalism at the Cronkite School out at Arizona State University. Mickey, thanks a bunch.
Thank you, Kai.
General Motors shares gave back just a little bit today. The three main indices were higher. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Federal Reserve has, for the past 5 or 6 years or so, been getting creative, one might say, with monetary policy, all in an attempt to get and keep the American economy on an even keel. Today, the European Central Bank got with the program. In what you could call a surprise announcement, the ECB pushed interest rates to zero, actually to below zero for some deposits. That is a negative interest rate. So we asked Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith to do three things for us in the next minute and a half of our lives. One, explain exactly what a negative interest rate is. Number two, why the ECB thinks that will help the European economy. And number three, what it might mean here.
An interest rate is money a bank gives you for keeping your cash with them. And a negative interest rate? Bethan Bovino is an economist at Standard & Poor's.
What that means is that they are now charging commercial banks for leaving money at the central bank.
So you pay the bank to keep your money there. And how does that help Europe's economy?
It's trying to create a hot seat.
Paul Kudrowski is a partner at SK Ventures.
They just want to make it so darn uncomfortable to continue sitting there with your deposits that you say, oh, screw it, I'll lend it out.
Lending is exactly what European banks haven't been doing. They've been playing it safe, stashing their money with the ECB. Businesses and individuals aren't getting loans, so they aren't hiring or buying, and Europe's economy is grinding to a halt.
The central bank, their business is to get the real economy going.
Bethan Bovino says to do that, the ECB is making it expensive for banks to save.
Hopefully that means more lending to households and businesses.
So, will it work? Matthew Slaughter is a professor at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business, and he has his doubts.
Many banks in Europe are still fragile and recovering from the trauma of the world financial crisis. How much more likely they will be to make a lot more loans is an open question.
Slaughter says banks might just put their money in another safe haven, like U.S. Treasury bonds, which would be good for the U.S., but wouldn't help Europe much. The ECB can only make the seat hot. Now it's up to the banks to decide where to move their assets. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
There were some figures out today on the housing market. Good figures, actually. The number of homeowners underwater on their mortgages, that is, owing more than the home is worth, is down dramatically from last year. Dan Bobkoff has that story.
The Tampa area has more underwater mortgages than anywhere else in America, 30%. But even there, things are getting better fast.
We're seeing fewer people that are underwater. Prices have come back up.
Brad Monroe is director of the Greater Tampa Association of Realtors, and he says homeowners are telling his members they're finally out from under their mortgages and ready to move. Data from CoreLogic show nationally about 12% of homeowners owe more than their homes are worth. That's a big drop from the first quarter last year when the number was around 20%.
Which is really good news for the housing market.
Mark Fleming is CoreLogic's chief economist.
So many homeowners didn't have equity or were under-equitied. They didn't participate in listing their homes for sale, and that's why house prices increased over the last year or two so dramatically in those markets.
Fleming says this is a virtuous cycle. Rising home values brought back equity to a lot of homeowners. That means more people can move if they want to, and more homes on the market keeps prices from rising too fast. But just because you're no longer underwater in your mortgage doesn't mean you can move right away. Kostia Graducci of Black Knight Financial says you have to have enough equity to pay for a down payment and expenses.
Paying broker fees, for example, and if you only have 5% of equity in your house, you're not going to be able to cover those costs.
He says one in five homeowners today doesn't have enough equity in their current home to afford a new one. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
As we've been talking about this week, we have decided that after 25 years on the radio, it's time to do something else, something different. So we went ahead and put together a live and in-person stage show about the numbers that seem to be so much at the heart of business and economic journalism today. It's an hour and a half of fun that we like to call How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers.
You see them every day.
GDP.
Gosh, I don't know.
So inflation. What is it?
What does credit mean to you?
We did our first live show in Washington, D.C. about 6 weeks ago, pretty much the white-hot center of economic number crunching. And so we figured who better to talk to than the person who does that for the Congress of the United States. Douglas Elmendorf is the director of the Congressional Budget Office.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
I will point out, first of all, that you're an economist by training, so you know whereof you speak, unlike, you know, some of us. Who are you talking to when you put a report out? Are you talking to us, or are you talking to guys like you?
We're
and ladies and women and, you know, infants and children like you.
So that is scary.
I don't know.
We are talking.
Never mind.
We're talking to the members of Congress and their staffs. They're the people for whom we work, and we need to make our analysis understandable, transparent to them. We're very pleased that lots of other people come to our website and read our work and report on our work. But our principal mission is to serve Congress.
Does it make you crazy, then, when your work, which is provided to that specific audience, is taken in this political town and fairly ripped right out of context? I mean, the most recent example was that report out on the minimum wage and how it was going to cost President Obama's plan to raise the minimum wage and how it was going to cost all these jobs. And it got tossed around like a political football by everybody. That must make you bananas.
Well, I try not to get frustrated.
How does that go for you? How does that work? Let me know.
You know, we understand that we are operating in a partisan town where there are very strongly held views that are very far apart. Our role is to be the nonpartisan source of information. And we recognize that people will pick pieces of our analysis that serve their causes and quote those pieces. All we can do is to try to lay out in our own analysis the pros and the cons, the good points and the bad points, to try to give a complete picture. And we hope that reporters will report it as a complete picture. When we think that there's been something that's been very badly reported, then we'll talk to an individual reporter if we think something was misunderstood. And if we think there's been a broader misunderstanding, then we'll sometimes write a blog post to explain. So our blog often just reports announcements
happened.
Of new reports, but sometimes we write about write explanations.
And that's what happened with that minimum wage thing, right? There was a follow-up by your office after it all blew up.
A number of things this year where there's been a particularly complicated or subtle set of issues, and we think that the full story didn't come across the way we had intended, then we'll write some follow-up and try to explain it a little further.
You've been at this a long time. In this town, in various parts of the government. No aspersions on age here, right? Do you find us relying more on the snapshots, on the quick and easy numbers, now in this age of absolutely instantaneous journalism and data dissemination?
I think basically, I'm not an expert at this, but I think basically the reporting of numbers has improved over time. It is true that there's an immediacy, I think, that can get in the way of a clear story.
Right.
There can be a need that reporters feel to put some story up right away. And we actually spend more time now than we used to with reporters talking about our results on an embargoed basis before they're released for some of our larger reports to try to help them get that first story right. But I think basically there's a greatly increased number of people who are skilled with numbers and with words and with explaining things in ways that non-experts can understand. So I think it's a great era for this, but there are dangers in misinterpretation.
Well, elaborate then. What are the dangers? What are we not doing that we ought to do?
I think when we write up some analysis we've done, we'll have a few paragraphs, and there are a lot of caveats in there, and the caveats are actually important. They're not there just because we're trying to fill space. They're there because we think they're important aspects of what we've done or what the policy proposal is that people should understand. And the concern that I have is that when other people try to boil those results down, that the caveats can get lost.
Doug Elmendorf is the director of the CBO. Thank you so much for coming in. Really appreciate your time. We get to go up that way. Our live show tour dates for the rest of the year are on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, art is expensive.
As a band trying to break through, it's incredibly prohibitive. If a large or medium-sized tour, you're then expected to front 10 grand to even do the tour.
What do you say? Subsidies? Sure. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 98 points today. That is a 0.5%, closed at 16,836. The NASDAQ lifted 44 points, 1%, ended things at 4,296. The S&P 500 advanced 12.6%, ended things at 1940 there. News that Sprint and T-Mobile are a step close to a merger did not sit well with investors today. Sprint off 4%, T-Mobile dropped 2.3%. Bank stocks lifted on the news that Citigroup won't be forced to admit wrongdoing in a settlement it made 3 years ago with the SEC. Citi popped up 1.5% today. Amazon speared a 5% gain after the company tweeted a picture of a smartphone that it reportedly plans to unveil later this month. Bond prices? Well, they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.58%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up tomorrow. It's the first Friday of the month, which means all eyes will be on the May jobs report. Has word gotten around your office that tomorrow is National Donut Day? It was established in 1938 as a fundraiser for the Salvation Army in Chicago to help those in need during the Great Depression. And the Great Wisconsin Cheese Festival gets underway in Little Chute. You heard right. Donuts and cheese. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Apple, we learned this week, is getting into healthcare. As part of the new operating system it rolled out on Monday, they are going to have something called HealthKit. It'll aggregate all the data from your various fitness apps and send it to quote-unquote partners like Nike and the Mayo Clinic to hopefully make you healthier. As it happens, the city of Camden, New Jersey is doing something similar. No fancy apps there, just hospitals sharing data amongst themselves. Your data. Prescriptions, past procedures, doctor's notes, the whole smash. In the process, saving money and, yes, one hopes giving better care. From the Health Desk at WHYY Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has another installment of our series, Diagnosis Data.
So let's say a guy walks into the ER at Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital in Camden. Before Dr. Al Saccheti meets him, Saccheti will know that he's been to two other hospitals in town and what the doctors did when our hypothetical guy was there.
Okay, these guys worked him up for a GI problem, and these guys worked him up for a kidney problem. So I'm going to find out what else could it be that's causing the problem.
When doctors and hospitals share patient data, prescriptions, past procedures, physician notes, patients can get more focused, arguably better care. And Saccheti says hospitals can save money because the more information he's got on a patient, the less rooting around he's got to do.
If every provider you go to starts on square zero and goes down the same three blind paths, you're winding up with a lot of duplicated care.
Those blind paths are expensive, with several studies saying sharing patient data could save as much as $80 billion a year if every hospital and doctor got into the game. Right now, just a fraction share data through health information exchanges, or HIEs. Camden's three hospitals, Our Lady of Lourdes, Cooper University Health System, and Virtual Health, are all in, sharing data on the city's 30,000 Medicaid patients.
Is what's happening in Camden like in the best interest of their patients? I think you would say yes. You go to most other places, you would say no.
University of Michigan professor Julia Adler-Milstein, who studies HIEs, says it's near impossible to find another city in America where all the competing hospitals are working together. She says when most hospitals share this information, they share it to improve their bottom line. They don't see any competitive advantage to share with rivals.
It's not that they don't see the potential benefits. It's that the downside in terms of how many patients are they going to lose, that's uncertain. That's really hard to know. And so that makes it a bad investment.
So what makes Camden's hospital executives do what most of their colleagues don't?
God, we trust everyone else needs data.
Dr. Anthony Mazzarelli, a senior vice president at Cooper, says long before the HIE, primary care doctor Jeff Brenner began tracking some of the city's sickest and most expensive patients. Mazzarelli remembers Brenner telling mesmerizing and horrific stories, like one guy who had 300 emergency room visits in a year.
I mean, there's only 365 days. I think before this, every health system thought they were carrying the burden. And now you realize, well, we're all carrying this unbelievable burden on the same patients.
Those stories cracked open the door to modest data sharing, and that helped the hospitals get their arms around the problem. Pretty soon, Kim Barnes with Our Lady of Lourdes says everybody could see it was in their economic interest to share patient data, at least on their Medicaid patients.
You realize that problem's going to be solved by partnering. Those pictures are painted very clearly when you see the data.
Mazzarelli predicts what took Camden a decade might be quicker elsewhere as incentives move and more providers get paid to keep costs down.
I wish that shifting the incentives didn't change things in our healthcare system, but it's becoming pretty clear it probably will make a difference.
Executives at all three Camden hospitals say they imagine a day soon when they'll exchange data for all their patients. Mazzarelli says the incentive undertow is so strong that the patients the hospitals have gone to war over for decades, gold-plated, privately insured patients, are becoming more valuable as something shared than something guarded. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Diagnosis Data is produced with support from Healthy States. That's a project of American Public Media. You can get them at healthystates.org. Government subsidies for the performing arts over in the UK have traditionally gone to the usual suspects, ballet, opera, and theater. Now, though, some funding for a somewhat less exalted area of creativity, thrash metal bands, acid punk, and new grunge. The idea is to promote British musical talent overseas by subsidizing their foreign tours. Bands say they need the help because they're losing so much money from piracy and that live tours are the only way for them to make a living. Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Forget subsidies for steel or other heavy industries. The British government's pouring cash into heavy metal. This thrash metal band called Savage Messiah is getting a government grant to the tune of $25,000. At the offices of their recording label, Earache Records, Dave Silver of Savage Messiah told me the subsidy is a godsend.
As a band trying to break through, it's incredibly prohibitive. If a large or medium-sized tour, you're then expected to front 10 grand to even do the tour. I think it just helps us break into that market.
With shoulder-length hair and clad in black leather and denim, the band exudes an authentic, hardcore, heavy metal aura.
Is this going to be sex, drugs and rock and roll at the taxpayers' expense?
No, I mean, there are a lot of regulations.
The taxpayer will not be footing the bill for tattoos, studs, chin spikes or other body piercing, let alone picking up the tab for wrecked hotel rooms and wild parties. Not that Dave indulges in such excesses.
I mean, I don't actually drink alcohol at all. I haven't drunk in like 6 years. I don't smoke, don't take drugs. So, we're pretty well behaved, really.
But well-behaved or not, is a thrash metal band, or come to that a new grunge group, a suitable enterprise for subsidy? Lynn McDowell of the British recording industry says yes, the government should support a successful UK export. 1 in 10 of all albums sold in the US are by British artists. So why the need for a subsidy?
The money from the Music Export Growth Scheme is really about supporting up-and-coming talent, supporting independent record labels, and helping small businesses to export our great talent overseas.
News of the subsidy did not go down well here at the offices of the Taxpayers Alliance. The group's political director, Dia Chakravarti, says this is a clear waste of taxpayers' money.
British bands have a long history of breaking overseas markets, but that is because they had great songs to sing, not because of taxpayer subsidies.
And she speaks with a very particular interest in the music industry.
I've actually just finished working on my first album, but I've supported that by having my day job.
Working for the Taxpayers Alliance.
Working for the Taxpayers Alliance, indeed, and I've not taken a single penny from the taxpayers.
Dia's album of Bangladeshi music will be released soon. Oddly enough, her argument against subsidy strikes a chord back at Earache Records. Dave Silver of Savage Messiah divides his time between headbanging and studying economics. And he's a real fan of the Austrian School of Economics, which favours the free market. So why accept that government grant?
We are a band, there are four people in the band, and not everyone in the band is of the Austrian School of Economics, so what can we do?
And what's more, he says, with revenues under pressure from piracy, the band has got to break into the still lucrative field of overseas touring. he has to swallow his free market principles.
In an ideal world, if it moves, privatise it, you have no state intervention in the economy whatsoever, but that's not where we're at now, so...
In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, in which IKEA reveals that it knows way too much about us. The Swedish furniture and random stuff company did a survey of people in 8 cities around the world, one of which was New York. Here are just some quick tidbits to get you to click on the link. 56% of New Yorkers do not see themselves as morning people, we now know. Men spend an average of 12 minutes on grooming in the mornings, 19 minutes for women. And this one to leave you with, 1 in 6 New Yorkers say they take work into the bathroom with them, which, come on, really? Cut it out. We, of course, have the link on our website. It is marketplace.org. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow up 98 points, about 0.5%. The NASDAQ gained 44 points. That is 1%. The S&P 500 up 12 points. That is 0.6%. John Buckley, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, George Judson, Ethan Lindsay, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Sarah Gilbert. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.